Glenn Roberts is the founder of heritage grain company Anson Mills. He grows, processes, sells, and distributes handmade mill goods made from organic heirloom grains. Glenn sells his grains to famous chefs all over the world, but he is anything but a typical grain purveyor. For one thing, his own personal family story reflects how grains, specifically the strain called Carolina Gold, were vital to his mother's survival during hard times.
My mother was born in Delaware and moved to Aiken, South Carolina, which is only 40-some miles from my mill today, and also lived on Edisto Island. They had a summer home there, and she also lived in Savannah. Her dad was doing horse work with the Ford family, running Ocala to Maine. He's a trainer. So in Aiken, my mother was pretty deep into the horse crowd. Then the Depression hit. They lost everything. My mom had to go to work for her nanny. She almost starved, and the way she kept from starving is she started farming her own stuff and then cleaning houses. And her nanny taught her how to grow and pound rice and on Edisto and in Aiken both. So she,
wow,
she grew up growing, harvesting, hand-pounding Carolina Gold herself.
With that family history as a backdrop, Glenn gives away tons of seed to anyone who can show the need for them. Even more importantly, Glenn sees the cultivation of grains like his seriously delicious Carolina Gold rice through a socio-political lens. The racial history of the rice trade in America is a narrative that more people should know. That and Glenn's own story are coming up next on Special Sauce, the podcast about food and life. I'm Ed Levine. So good to have you on Special Sauce, Glenn. So first of all, how and why did you get so interested in rice, specifically Carolina Gold rice? And first tell us about what Carolina Gold rice is.
I got very interested in this in the early 90s, even though I'd had a childhood interest in it because I was consuming it. Even though I'm not African or Native, I understand where that comes from. The multi-generational retained stress of a suppression would speak against the culture itself. What we decided was that we should confront that culture and try to overcome it, because it is a world famous rice and it does deserve to be on everyone's table. So we decided we'd start doing this project called Anson Mills, and we'd make chefs happy with extraordinary flavor, texture, palate memory, stuff that actually grips you and you say, I need to have that again. That's good. And every time you taste it, you say, oh yeah, I remember. This is it. If you have food like that and you have seed, because there's still no seed company. It's just starting now. It's taken 24 years to get a seed company behind Carolina Gold rice seed. If you can imagine that, you're keeping your own seed. It sounds easy. It's not.
You've said that in a way, Carolina Gold rice represents the horror of slavery.
It does. We know the saga and odysseys of various rices, starting shortly after first contact in the Cape Vineyard area today, Martha's Vineyard. We even had rice here in the pharmacopoeia for medicine for the whaling fleet. The Jewish Quaker school in Philadelphia, shepherded forward by our buddy Benjamin Franklin, was doing medicinal rices for Pepsis for making medicine. Rice flour is non-reactive in the human digestive system. So if you're doing medicines, it's great to mix rice flour in with it. It makes it easier to digest. So as far as medicine goes, rice was here even before first contact, because native people were doing the same thing with wild rice, even though that's not technically rice. But rice itself in the settlement of Carolinas kicked off very early. Our first rice growers were Italians, and the slaves in those fields were indentured Irish and Native people. So it was horrific from the beginning, unfortunately. And there's all sorts of different ideas about this, but I'm pretty convinced, even though I don't have peer-reviewed documentation, that Carolina Gold rice itself emanated from Sulawesi, came in maybe across through Madagascar, hit East Africa, went across Africa, to West Africa, Senegambia, and surrounds Nigeria, and shoots over with the slave trade, and somehow appears just north of Charleston on one of the great river plantations. And again, since it's a white heritage history, we don't give Africans credit for any of the transit, the discovery, the maintenance of it. But it was all African women doing the seedsmanship, because that seed is difficult to maintain. And African women didn't even figure in this, even though they brought them over. And I guarantee you, the ones they brought over as slaves were highly qualified as seed people as well. They were probably elders. So having said all that, the system of Carolina Gold went viral. And we had 6, maybe even 7 different cultivars that were distinct. And all but one disappeared after the Civil War, unfortunately. African Americans kept what we know of Carolina Gold today viable in the Midlands system, which was all barter and off the grid after the Civil War. And had they not done that, we wouldn't have retained the rice at all. It went to Texas, blew up in Missouri after the Santee was flooded, which is the river system just north of Charleston, where unfortunately African freeman families were farming Carolina Gold on their own seed. And they left and they went to what's now Arkansas and Missouri and took Carolina Gold over there. And that became the nexus center for the seed, drifted down into Texas, and Texas became the number one producer of Carolina Gold after the Civil War. So that was retained in Texas up until, I guess, 1950, 60. We had freeman growing essentially hidden garden rices in Carolina Gold culture on the Carolina Sea Islands, the last place the rice was present. And some people think it was actually up into 1970s before it disappeared completely.
You have said that Charleston became this huge rice cultivation center and this sort of the center of the rice trade. Basically, that industry was built on slave labor, and that when the Civil War came around, I saw that you said something like the business model was broken because they no longer had access to the free labor.
Not just that, but that's the largest factor. If you stop and think about it, we had maybe a 2-decade suspension of crazy with regard to our relationship with African and Native people. Native people had it worse than Africans. You know, we wiped them all out in the War of the Embassy. And those few that migrated back into the Sea Island and coastal Carolina, Georgia system, where all that rice was produced, and you're right, it was the largest rice production area in colonial America, and it lasted up until the Civil War. It was the largest rice production area in our country. So what happened with that culture is we quote-unquote emancipated everybody, and Juneteenth is a pretty good example of how confusing that was. And that's a Texas story. The South Carolina story is even weirder. They created alliance halls to support African farmers to keep the market fair, and the African farmers had to get secret alliance halls to protect their own interests. Used to call it being pencil whipped at the processor. White guy take stuff in, everything be fine. Black guy take stuff in, could be good, better than, almost as good as, and it was marked down huge. So they set their own alliances up to protect themselves. And for 20 or so years after the Civil War, that was working. Then Jim Crow hit and all bets are off. I mean, it just goes crazy. The stuff that happened is almost impossible to track, with the Black Belt in Alabama still recovering. We're still finding out stuff that we lost during that period. We lost all the cultivars except for one of Carolina Gold. All of them. 6 world-important rice cultivars that were different kinds of rices. It wasn't just the Carolina rice we know today, which is almost a medium grain, even though it is a long grain. But it had, all of them had the same starch quality, but there was a super long grain called Long Gold, Northern Rice. It had a lot of different names, but that was the one that was most famous worldwide, and it disappeared completely everywhere.
Your business, there's sort of 2 aspects to Anson Mills. One is you sell grains, rice, corn-derived products to chefs and other people, and then you give away millions of pounds of seeds to people that have a need for it.
Right.
You've described that aspect of your business almost as a form of reparations.
yeah, I mean, what else are we going to do? If you look at what happened when Jim Crow hit, obviously you stayed, you die, you go, you had a chance. So in order to have a fair, non-extractive, and today it's called Nagoya Protocol, which is the purest one, that Nagoya Protocol applies to the genetic sovereignty of the rice. Before the Industrial Revolution, almost all farmers, black, white, green, yellow, whatever color, did not monetize seed. You blew up your farm seed, your neighbors gave you seed, you'd pay them back with seed. There wasn't any money exchanged. And that was the biosecure system for an entire East Coast during the colonial era up until probably 1850, 1860, 1870, something like that. And we said, well, since the plants we're growing are endemic to those eras, then we will do it the way they used to do it, even if it doesn't make commercial sense. Now, people who are very bright look at our quote-unquote business model, which is a hoot, and they say, what are you doing? And we say, well, we do a lot of research, try to keep biosecurity in all the seed lines we work with, because we work with more than rice, obviously, and we have lots of rices. And then we give the seed away. And they say, what kind of business model is that? I said, I don't know. It's not a business model, but it's a cultural model. And it's frankly the one that's been around since the dawn of, you know, civilization. That's the one that keeps civilizations biosecure. You watch them start to screw with seed. And just like in Guns, Germs, and Steel, the civilization goes up as the seed and biosecurity is perfect. And then as that civilization peaks out, you watch the seed blow up. And in the case of Guns, Germs, and Steel, he's speaking about barley, but you can pick any staple crop and watch that happen. And I was at least not dumb enough to miss that. I worked closely for decades now with Scott Peacock. We both knew Edna Lewis really, really well.
Scott Peacock was a chef in Atlanta. And of course, Edna Lewis was one of the founding people of Persons.
Yeah.
Who knows? of American cuisine, a fantastic African-American chef who wrote many great books and cooked in Atlanta and in New York City.
And I didn't know Scott, but when Scott decided to move back to Marion, Alabama and dedicate the rest of his life to supporting underserved Black communities in the Black Belt, which is what he's done very quietly and with diligence now for a decade and a half, you know, Dad, I went over to visit with him because he's fun. And then we went up to see a guy named Hunter Lewis, who's invented hedge funds, amongst other things. He's a UVA economist, professor, postdoc level. He created a model farm in the Black Belt to benefit local underserved communities. It's almost 10,000 acres, and it's perfect. No chemicals, no nothing. And I did the rices with Scott for Hunter Lewis, et cetera, et cetera. So we worked together in the Black Belt, and I got to see firsthand over and over and over again how screwed up everything is on that level. And again, it was the first place the USDA finally recognized some reparations, because after allowing everyone to steal from those Black farmers, including stealing the land, they started to repay it. So that was under Obama, and that's moving forward. And I think there's a lot more coming. It's not reparations from me to do what we're doing. I think for biosecurity, given climate change, way past the legal and economic and other reasons, just being able to eat properly becomes a mandate for everyone.
We'll have more Special Sauce with Glenn Roberts and why he, despite all his knowledge of grains, wasn't allowed to cook rice in his own family. Stick with us. You ever own something that inspired you to up your game? I just bought a beautiful new carbon steel flat bottom wok. Now I really want to get the most out of it. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. What do I mean? Well, the all-new Lexus GX can come with 33-inch all-terrain tires,
those would make my driving on dirt roads near my house a lot smoother. Just like the flat bottom on my new wok will enable me to up my cooking game. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
So you mentioned your mom, and she inspired you in some ways to do your work. She was a really good cook. She really was very particular about cooking rice. And apparently you could never live up to her standards. Is it true that she would tell you to go feed your rice to the animals?
I was given the dog chef title in our house. My sister got to cook rice for our family. I was never allowed to. Honestly, to this minute, I'm not quite sure why she wouldn't even allow me to cook rice for her when she came out to live with us on Folly Island in Sullivan's Island. My buddy, George Durst, who's got Durst family practice on Sullivan's Island, his family goes back there forever. He took care of my mother, and we were laughing about that 2 weeks ago, that she told George, don't ever let Glenn cook rice for you. You know, I'm going, really wait funny. A second, I'm a rice guy. I know how to do this with my eyes closed. But yeah, and I think part of that spurred me into this with a little bit more energy than I would have had too. I'm terrible at production in a kitchen. I'm really great as an auxiliary person in making large culinary facilities, including great chefs, better. I'm really good at it. I'm good for looking at the side, looking through the pass. If you put me on the other side of the pass, I'm all thumbs. I stick my foot in boiling water, et cetera, et cetera. I can cook really well for two, maybe four, as long as no one's looking. Other than that, I'm useless. But I know food inside and out in a lot of ways, so worldwide too. But it's just weird. It doesn't sync up for doing cooking for a group. If I have to cook for a group of 10, I just don't do it anymore, you know? I help. I wash dishes. I'm the plongeur. And I'll prep. I'm really good as a commis and garde-manger. Yep. But not hot pans. I only do that for Kay, who's my darling wife, Kay, who lives here on the island. I cook for Kay. And she lets me cook for her, you know? And I haven't poisoned her yet that I know of. And we have a group of friends that I'll take a dish to. And no one's died. So I think... But I was the dog rice pet. Everybody in our house ate rice three meals a day, including the dogs and the cats, for that matter. Yeah.
So you did a lot of things before you started Anson Mills. From what I could tell, a bunch of things happened when you decided to start Anson Mills.
Yeah, I had the Smithsonian Board of Directors book, but it was a coup. I was helping a family that had multiple restaurants named the Baelishes. I didn't own it, but I volunteered to move into what's called the old Pink House today and just try to bring it up with nothing as fun, because I'd worked in multi-hundred million hotel projects and just didn't want to do that stuff anymore and was only doing historic architecture. And the old Pink House was the only Georgian I ever got to work with. And I said, it's a Georgian, I'll work on it. So I moved in and fixed it all up. And then Dick Schultz, Dr. Richard Schultz, who was farming his own Carolina gold across the river. And John Martin Taylor, the author, had made that world famous already by the time the old Pink House was put together. It's the last F&B project I worked on. And so we got up and running, and we had the Smithsonian coming, and everybody had all the food except for the rice. The rice was late from the field. We wanted it cut and delivered. And they couldn't get it cut and delivered, so they delivered rice from their stores, and it had weevils in it, and we didn't know you could just dunk it in water, all the weevils would float off. So we were there picking live weevils out of rice. I was in my suit, supposed to be doing a presentation, sweating, picking weevils out of rice. And, you know, the Schultz family has more to do with how we got to where we are than anybody else, I think, honestly. And Okotie, South Carolina, where Turnbridge Plantation is, that's where the rice was. That's where I first saw Carolina gold. So I saw it. I said, okay, we're serving this. We're going to hand harvest. We're going to bring it over. We'll serve new crop rice. I didn't really even know what that meant. But Richard Schultz Jr. was talking about how wonderful it was. And there was a guy working there named Roland Chalmers who kind of kept looking at me really hard. So I, on the way out, I talked to him And I thought I had it all. And the Smithsonian wrote me back. I sent them some documentation. They said, you need to read more because they know what they were doing. I didn't. So I dove in and read more and spent a lot of time in the archives at Owens Thomas House, et cetera, and got that meal to where it would be perfect without any kind of extraction or anything else. And we were going to have the growers in to do it, but we all were in the kitchen picking the rice, trying to get it because it was the main reason why we're doing this dinner. And we finally got the rice at the table, but I never gave the presentation. I sent somebody else out to do it, handed it to him. It was 10 pages. And that night, I just said, screw it, I'm going to grow my own rice. And I burnt my clothes in the parking lot.
And the first time I ever heard Anson Mills was about your grits, right? And the chefs quickly, you know, people like Sean Brock and everybody else, like, we love Anson Mills grits. And what's the difference between your grits and run-of-the-mill grits, no pun intended,
and, <That's good.
laughs> and Carolina Gold rice and good old Carolina rice?
There used to be two different types of food related to staple culture. There was new crop, which means we're just harvesting it and we're celebrating that harvest. And everybody assumes, well, we know this because we can go to the store and buy rice or grits or whatever. And that is not what people used to celebrate at harvest. At harvest, they had viable, back in the day, chem-free. There's no chemicals, so everything was chemical-free. And those were seed quality, and those foods, and take grits, for example, were alive. Hence, they're viable. Hence, they're breathing oxygen, and they're aerobic. And the aerobic aroma flavor profile changes drastically when it goes dormant. And it's either 60, 120 days, somewhere in there, it goes dormant, then the seed stops respiring completely and or almost completely. And if it's respiring at all, it's respiring CO2. So it's more like people and animals when you harvest corn right out of the field. And when it's stored, it's provision corn, and it's either, it can be dead, that most everything on a grocery store shelf has to be dead because it needs to be stable. That's called shelf stability. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. Provision culture was money in the Levant. Just caches of pasta were dowry, big money. So I'm not knocking that, but at the Industrial Revolution, we eliminated new crop aerobic viable grits, new crop aerobic viable rice. It all went away, and it's a different food. And it has to be handled quickly, and it's perishable. It's not shelf stable, which is why it didn't survive.
You even say to put your rice in the freezer.
Right. So it's still viable if you're doing bran work. All the older rices have very, very thin brown bran, very thin. Or they may have colored bran too, but it'd be thinner. The older you get, the thinner it is. That lowers phytates, amongst other things. With corn, you have just incredible field fresh flavors on top of good forward corn flavors, on top of minerality, on top of other nuttiness, on top of kind of floral stuff in the background. And it switches up all the time as aerobic culture, as mature dormant culture, which means it's non-aerobic anymore. It becomes that nutty, creamy, forward, wonderful corn stuff we get, which is fine. But kissing goodbye, especially when you're thinking biosecurity, climate change, and how we're going to feed people, kissing the first 90 days of any crop goodbye as a culinary crop, now it's expedient to get the stuff out of the field and eat it, the stuff out of the field and store it. And storing properly on a low carbon footprint would not necessarily mean using freezers like we do. So our carbon footprint is not the best so far, but we have ideas about how to change that too, because native people used to bury these things to keep them aerobic. And they knew how to line up those burial sites. That's how they saved seed. And we only work with seed grade, chem-free, organic staples. So our rices are out of the field. We plant sequentially, harvest sequentially. So we get 9 months of rice production where other people get one harvest. We've got multiples and they're all over the place. So we always have rice coming in and it's always new crop then. So we only do aerobic culture. It's perishable. It has an amazing aroma flavor profile. It's not something you can go out and get anyplace else. That's, if that's succinct, that's why the Carolina Gold that we grow tastes different than everyone else's Carolina Gold, even though it's great as provision rice too.
And so commercial rices that we all know are not new crop.
No, they're...
By definition.
By definition, they have to be dead. And once you mill them, especially if you're polishing them, you just have starch. So one could question the nutrition there too, because we also mill hand-pound emulation, which leaves the inner bran layer intact, the full germ on the seed intact, but scratches the outer bran layer, which makes it hydrate and look like white rice, quote-unquote, but it's actually almost completely the nutrition profile of brown rice. But it's highly perishable. The moment you scratch that bran, it's perishable.
How do you go about figuring out who gets those seeds?
We jury, and we're very lucky to have, I think, and I'd be very happy to be wrong, the best collection of public domain geneticists left on the planet. And they're all over the world, and they're amazing. Martha Wilcox worked at Seaman all this time. She's with Bill Tracy at University of Wisconsin right now because she's seen everything having to do with meso foods. She knows it inside and out. She's got a photographic memory. Steve Jones is world famous for the Bread Lab, has been digging into local environmental wheat culture in the upper Pacific Northwest, but he's worked all over the world, especially in Italy and in the Levant. So he knows that inside out. Abdullah Jaradat, who's now retired, unfortunately, one of the best emmer specialists ever.
So these people are all on your jury.
They're, I call them if I have questions, yes. But the bottom line, if they're not jurying, I am. You know, I take responsibility for this. I make the decision, even though we're talking about it right now in public. It's fairly private because you got to contact me and then we think this through because we're talking about large and small donations, essentially.
So people just find out about Anson Mills, and if they are in need of your seeds, they contact you.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is that your business is technically not a nonprofit,
nope.
But its mission is not to maximize profit.
Anson Mills was founded to feed people. That's never changed. That started in 1995, but actually became formal in 1998. So we're coming up on a quarter century of for real doing it, and we've got here. The second principle would be, I want my daughter, Ansley, who's in the Pacific Northwest, seeing one of everything weather-wise herself. She was in Santa Monica before it blew up, too, so she's seen it all firsthand, drove out through the fires. So I want my daughter and her kids to be able to eat. And frankly, it may sound slightly hysterical, sorry, but I've been in biosecurity now for almost a quarter century. And my rice geneticist, when I asked her when she started being concerned about biosecurity, she said 1983 and we were late. And when she said that, that was 3 years ago.
So what's your end goal with Anson Mills?
We had, even though it wasn't sustainable, we had 14 central mills per county or whatever area you want to say on that level during colonial, all the way up to the Civil War. In some cases, even more than that, but the average, I believe, was around 14 per county. Why? Because you could walk out and walk back, take unprocessed grain out, bring it home. So it was three out, two back, and you do it with your kids if you didn't have a mule, et cetera, et cetera. So that was survivable, and that was a biosecure system. And frankly, it lasted past World War II. There were still communities doing it. There still are some here in New England. They're not in the public eye, but they're Mennonite and others that are still doing it. And there are also a few in Pennsylvania. I don't know of any in Maryland, or I don't think there's any in Virginia either. I think there's a couple in North Carolina. So I would like to see on a staple side, everyone get back to that. And so I still think that there's reasons for industrial production. It's important, but it's not important like we're using it here in this country.
So what can other serious eaters do to help your cause besides buying your products?
I think encourage the people that are interested or themselves or both to grow some of these things. Why don't people grow rice? They used to. They grow rice in their garden. You can eat it. It's really good. You can buy a bicycle huller for almost nothing. You can get a hand crank huller for literally nothing. And you can actually grow your own rice and hull it and cook it. It's the best stuff in the world. And if you do it chem-free and take care of it, it's a wonderful thing. And there are rices that grows anywhere in the United States, even in Alaska, certainly in Hawaii, anywhere. Some of the best rice in the United States is grown in Arizona. Give me a break. That's not where you'd expect to be seeing rice. Native people were doing that.
One final question about this issue of race and rice is, do you think it's one of those things that people are reluctant to acknowledge or talk about?
Well, I think if you're white and you're not uncomfortable, you're missing something, number one. Number two, it's Native and African both, and probably even more Native than African, not to judge it. And from my view, and I'm not an expert, but I sure have seen a lot of it and I grew up with it. So having said that, I think that the dialogue is out there now. The BJ Dennis, geez, Jessica's had tons of...
Right. We should say that Jessica Harris wrote the book, High on the Hog, that the Netflix series was based on. I think she was also an executive producer or certainly a consultant. And BJ Dennis was an African-American chef from South Carolina who was also in the series.
BJ is a Sea Island chef, and he grew up on the Sea Islands. He grew up in Charleston, and he grew up on the rich side and the poor side. He's done it all, and he chose to do what he's doing, which is exceptional. I don't know anyone else like him. He's amazing. But if I pick these things out and say, okay, the dialogue is closer to the American disciplinary dialogue, I think on a academic scale, it's never been more vital and more alive. I think on the cultural side and in the main of society that we have huge distance to travel. And I'm concerned that it will be something that has been very popular in media, but never got to the ground. And I say that because I can still go to places where they're barely eking it out and they deserve better than that. And they're barely eking it out because they're generations into being underserved, undersupported, not given the opportunities that somebody like I would get, et cetera, et cetera. So do I think that people find this uncomfortable? I think that if they're me, yes, I find it uncomfortable, but it doesn't make it any less immediate. And I think that you can put it out front, and we do. And we support, even though it's not our business, we support that because it's the future. The African women did the rice seed. We became a major world rice producer because of African and Native women. Native women were always the seed people. African women were always the seed people. It's a matriarchal-driven system. I've worked with a lot of them. They're brilliant. So the more the merrier, more women in farming. That's my motto.
Are you nonetheless optimistic about the future when it comes to this stuff? Or you just don't think in terms of optimism or pessimism? You just like put your head down, do your work.
Oh, if you're farming and you're not an optimist, you aren't a farmer. You know, the old joke, you know, farmer wins $10 million and he's being interviewed, and the guy interviewing the farmer says, well, what are you going to do with all that money? He said, well, I think I'll keep farming until the money runs out. You know, that's the oldest joke in the book. But I'm optimistic about biosecurity. I'm lucky to work with people that understand it. I don't even understand it. I just know it has to be done. And I'm doing what I can to help, which is me just going out and confronting my own ignorance in the field and going, oh, well, I lost that field. And so how many can I afford to lose? Not a whole lot more. So if I get over 50%, I'll be doing well, because we were running about 30% recovery on harvest from our acreage when we started. It's up about 60 now, but we've lost a ton of crops this year, and it was beyond my control. And that is true across the country. What to do? Find heat tolerant, cold tolerant, drought tolerant, water tolerant, shade tolerant, light tolerant, whatever tolerant crops, and get those in the ground and make sure they're tasty. That's what I'm into. That's optimistic, because instead of worrying about, oh, my favorite thing isn't growing right this year, find something that is. There's only 300 million different choices in our grain banks around the world. Go look.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us. It was indeed a pleasure to hear about your unusual and groundbreaking enterprise.
It's an honor, and thank you.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. Remember to look for Glenn Roberts' extraordinary grains. The easiest way to find them is on the Anson Mills website. This episode was produced by Pedro Rafael Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez of PRX Productions. If you want more Special Sauce in your life, just subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to the SpecialSaucePodcast.com where you'll find all the new episodes. I'm Ed Levine. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.